Okay. Openness, 92. Conscientiousness, 63. Negative emotionality, 25. Extroversion, 58. Agreeableness, 17.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk, and we're here to talk about another candidate declaring that she's exploring a run for president. Before we get started, on our podcast earlier this week, there was some interest in a sound effect to announce whenever a new person enters the presidential race. So, you ask, I deliver. Ladies and gentlemen, our 2020 announcement music, here it is. And with that, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is running for president. And here with me to talk about the theory of why Gillibrand could be the 2020 Democratic nominee or not are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going well.
Senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire. How's it going?
Hi.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah. How's it going?
Thanks for having me.
So
I'm agreeable.
I'm agreeing. I'm agreeable.
Likeable.
For context, we all just took a personality test, and now we're deciphering our own personalities as we display them on this podcast.
Listeners, please go to 538.com, take that personality test. We'd love to know how you compare to our office, which tends to be creative but not very agreeable.
Open and disagreeable journalists.
Yeah. We'll make a, to Tony's idea, we'll make a politics podcast listener group for the personality test.
And we'll find out all of the positive and negative qualities of our listeners.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about Gillibrand. She made her announcement on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert Tuesday night. So let's begin by listening to a bit of what she said. This clip is on the longer side, but it's good background for understanding what her pitch is.
Well, I'm going to run for president of the United States because as a young mom, I'm going to fight for other people's kids as hard as I would fight for my own, which is why I believe that healthcare should be a right and not a privilege. It's why I believe we should have better public schools for our kids because it shouldn't matter what block you grow up on. And I believe that anybody who wants to work hard enough should be able to get whatever job training they need to earn their way into the middle class. But you are never going to accomplish any of these things if you don't take on the systems of power that make all of that impossible, which is taking on institutional racism. It's taking on the corruption and greed in Washington, taking on the special interests that write legislation in the dead of night.
All right, so we're going to get into the theory for why she'll win or lose the Democratic nomination, but just listening to that, Claire, what did you make of her announcement last night?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting the venue that she chose. The Late Show with Stephen Colbert is a little bit unorthodox, I would say. I mean, people go on there sometimes to tease things that they're going to do politically, but, you know, it's a comedic venue. So it was kind of interesting. But I think that the idea was it reaches a large audience. It gets big play in the days after because probably with people who skew liberal because Colbert has kind of taken on this mantle of Trump skewerer. And I think that's important for her to get high profile coverage because she isn't that well known outside the political sphere. And I think that's going to be a big thing for her in the coming 18 months, whatever it is to kind of introduce herself. And we can talk about this more in depth, but she's introducing herself as a mother, as a candidate. That's sort of her play in a Democratic electorate that is filled with a lot of newly politically activated women.
I mean, here in New York, she's a little bit better known. She is one of our senators. The last time one of my senators ran for president, that was when I lived in Illinois, and President Obama became president.
Wow, what a track record, Nate.
Nate, what are you like? What is happening here? Are you claiming credit for? Are you predicting Gillibrand
would
win?
Yeah, I think this is
his
theory of the case for Kirsten Gillibrand. But let's talk about where she's situated in the field in terms of ideology and background before we, you know, make a pathway for her.
Yeah, Claire has a really good piece on this up on the site right now, which you can read for more detail here. But I don't think she's all that differentiated from the other candidates in terms of ideology. She holds pretty standard liberal positions on most issues for a member of the Democratic Party. Where she is trying to differentiate herself is in really emphasizing and leaning into women's issues and matters of equality, equity, and that's kind of her theory of the case. Is Claire had a quote in her piece on Gillibrand, which I think summed this up, Claire, right?
Yeah, it's from a Gillibrand campaign official who said that the lesson of 2018 is that the future of the Democratic Party is with women. And what they meant by that is the midterm elections saw a historic number of women elected to Congress. Most of those were Democratic women. Almost 60% of the Democratic primary electorate is women. And I think what's interesting about Gillibrand, you're right, Micah, she is a pretty, you know, run-of-the-mill Senate liberal for 2018. Of course, she's changed her political positions quite starkly over the past decade, which we can talk about since she served in an upstate House district. But I think what Gillibrand knows will be her way to differentiate herself is, you know, it was no mistake that she positioned herself as a young mother, right?
Yeah.
She is. There are going to be several women in the race. She, I think, is banking on the fact that she has two kids who are relatively young, I believe 10 and 15. She has, you know, if Warren is running as kind of the self-declared, like, angry woman, and, you know, they're leaning into that, a little bit more, you know, hard-nosed going after Trump. I think Gillibrand is positioning herself in kind of the exact opposite way, which is an interesting sort of leaning into the femininity of it, right? Or the societal perception of femininity, where she's kind of saying, this is going to be a positive campaign. This is a campaign about, I'm going to, you know, advocate as a mother for your children, right? It has a different tonality to it already. And I think that is very much on purpose. And I think it also, she sees herself as being able to win some of those perhaps disaffected white college-educated women who used to be Republican, in part because, you know, she used to represent a pretty Republican district.
On the podcast earlier this week, we discussed the five different constituencies within the Democratic Party that a successful nominee would have to piece together. Those were millennials, party loyalists, the left, African Americans, and Hispanic voters. Which pieces of the Democratic Party does she piece together in order to be successful?
Well, we just gave her the same score for all groups. And on the one hand, that could be good because it means you have upside potential with all groups. On the other hand, she had a reputation when she served from upstate New York as being pretty moderate. She was pro-Second Amendment and so forth, right? And then became a senator, replaced, I think, Hillary Clinton, right?
Yeah. Correct.
So I don't know. I mean, there's some critique like, oh, well, you know, she shifted policies. Well, maybe you should if you're representing a moderate district in upstate New York versus the entire state, which obviously is weighted with people in New York City that are more liberal and Westchester County and so forth. And so, you know, I'm not sure that criticism really holds. But then this past year, she was extremely anti-Trump. She had the lowest Trump agreement score of any senator in our database. It almost seemed at times like she went out of her way to oppose things that weren't terribly controversial so she could be the most anti-Trump senator and demonstrate how anti-Trump she is potentially. At the same time, she has a reputation for it, and she would say, because, hey, I'm from New York, and it's one of our constituencies, as being, like, Wall Street-friendly, or at least adjacent to Wall Street-friendliness. You know, I think her husband's, like, a British, like, investment banker, or not investment banker, excuse me.
He worked at a venture capital
firm. At a venture capital firm. And her style is, although there are exceptions, you can see her in hearings and stuff becoming more combative, right? But her style is a little bit more genial. It's kind of like an amalgam, in some ways, mm-hmm. of, like, four or five different candidates. And typically when you have a candidate like that, it's someone who is kind of like a front runner because they can afford to be all things to all people because they have a lot of institutional support, right? And so it's a weird motif to have if you're not a front runner, because then how do you have angles that help you to differentiate yourself and become a front runner, right? So it's a little bit like the underwear gnomes meme, right? Where like, okay, no one knows what that is.
I don't know what that is.
Now I want to know.
It's collect underwear, step one, step two, question mark, step three, profit, right? We're like, you know. If somehow she survives, outlasts a lot of other candidates, then I think she becomes stronger, right? Then I think she's like the anti-Bernie or someone, where Bernie is like appealing to like one or one and a half groups. You know, it's also in New York, she has a big gender split in her approval ratings. she has strong approval ratings with African-American and Hispanic voters, right? And so I'm a little bit wary of, you know, both me personally and, like, kind of the way most people in the press are white guys, right? And so they're like, well, I don't get the appeal of Gillibrand. Well, you know, you're actually a minority of the Democratic electorate.
The Democratic electorate. You know, using our coalitional view of the party, it is hard to see, you know, Nate wrote about this in his piece, we do not have a women corner of the party, right? Because women are a majority of the party and they're a majority of most of these groups. And therefore, it is hard to see where she gets a toehold in to start building that support. But that's only according to, like, a building coalition's view of the primary. If the primary unfolds differently, you know, she's among the most anti-Trump, as Nate said. She does really well among women, as Nate said. You know, those are two pretty good calling cards.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going back to Nate's five centers of power in the Democratic Party, to me, okay, she has to win party loyalists. And then, you know, her voting record suggests she's trying to court the left, but she also is, you know, like a former securities
moderate
lawyer, and she's a senator from New York, which means, and, you know, it's already been reported that she's fundraising, you know, or putting in fundraising calls to Wall Street. So although she said, you know, I'm not going to take PAC money, which I think is going to be a pretty standard line in the Democratic Party. So, you know, it's a little iffy to me on whether or not the left buys into that. I think millennials is like a decent ploy there. She's obviously aware of the fact that she is a white woman who is who kind of ran originally in a pretty white district and is aware that she needs to build some credibility with the black community. So it is kind of, I mean, I tend to think it's party loyalists plus millennials plus ... underwear gnomes.
That seems right to me,
But who knows?
One thought I have a little bit is she running in the wrong year? Because the message of, hey, I'm positive and solutions oriented, I'm a consensus builder, but I'm also, like, on the forefront of women's issues, and women are 52% of the overall electorate and 60% of the Democratic electorate. I mean, that feels like a bit of a message you might have if you had had a moderately popular two-term Republican president, right? Now you're kind of ready to turn the page with something newer and fresher and not terribly contentious, and someone kind of agreeable, I guess, to use that term. But, you know, she's polling at 1 or 2% or something. She is young and could wait longer, potentially. If you're a senator from New York, that's potentially a very powerful position.
The one thing I would push back on, Nate, is I think on policy, Gillibrand's rationale for running this year is, like, pretty clear and coherent and self-evident, in that on policy, in terms of her positions and her emphasis, she is creating a really good contrast with Trump. I think what you were saying, though, is more about sort of how she's campaigning tonally, in that Democrats might want more of a fighting tone.
And I think her campaign's response to that might be, maybe that's what the Democrats want, or maybe, you know, she can appeal to that base of women, but then also not have marked herself out as, like, the angry Trump counterpuncher, and that will make her attractive for the general election. This goes back to, why are we writing all these, like, how could so-and-so win the 2020 Democratic primary? It's because there are so many theories of the case of, like, how you go about it, that I think the idea of running on the almost more positive campaign vibe is, like, an interesting one. And it might, and very well might not be the winning strategy.
Yes.
Because, you know, Warren has obviously taken the opposite tact, which is kind of counterpunching. Counterpunching with also being backed up by, I am the pure progressive warrior kind of thing.
But Nate, your theory is Democrats are going to want more of a fighting tone, I should say.
I'm not necessarily, I mean, you know, I was very bearish on the Avenatti candidacy with that rationale. No, I'm just saying, like, why now, right? What's the urgency for her candidacy now? And how's that tied to, like, Trump?
Well, I think she had a big year in 2017. Now, this might take us into the Franken conversation, but, I mean, there was one kind of memorable magazine headline that called her the senator from Me Too. And obviously, she's a pretty long history of trying to reform military sexual assault policies, and the fact that she came out so hard against Franken. She was the first Democratic senator to publicly call for his resignation. Obviously, it's made her a lot of enemies in the donor class, but maybe it'll give her some grist with grassroots people. You don't know, but it's maybe she feels that momentum from if this is the year of the woman, if the women's marches started a political movement, then she might figure this is the best momentum I'm going to get.
Yeah, maybe I'm coming across more harsher than I.
Yeah, because that seems right to me. If she's the Me Too candidate, now seems like a perfect moment.
Okay, so to wrap up on her strengths, it's probably worth saying that she holds the record in New York State for the biggest win for a statewide candidate.
And
right?
She outperformed Cuomo and Hillary Clinton in 2016. So as you know,
Cuomo in 2018 and Clinton in 2016. So maybe let's talk about some of the challenges that she'll run into. Nate, I thought it was kind of interesting that you rated her the same on all of the different five corners of the party, including the left, which maybe gets at her Trump score. But it seemed like a lot of the backlash that came off of her calling for Al Franken's resignation came from a more left-leaning, whiter, male part of the party. Do you think that creates challenges for her, or do you think those are overcome in among other voters?
Oh, I don't know if the Franken thing came from the left. I think it came from
establishment
money,
donors,
money, money,
from
money.
You know,
Soros,
gross
explicitly.
Old white Clintonian people.
Oh, but I agree with that. But I also think there was some like Bernie bro element.
Maybe
to
a little,
it too.
A little bit.
Yeah, I saw reporting in Politico basically said the donor class is not happy with her. But you also saw a backlash from what I perceive to be the more Bernie Sanders-aligned left.
The thing about the Franken story is, to go a little anecdotal, you know, I would contrast this against the Elizabeth Warren DNA story, where if you're just having conversations with rank-and-file Democratic friends of yours who are not in media, you know, almost invariably they would say, oh, that DNA thing with Elizabeth Warren. And now the conversation about Warren's a little bit different. She declared and the page has been turned, at least partially, though I'm sure that will come back again, right? You know, I'm not sure that this Gillibrand killed Al Franken thing is as widespread in the real world as it is kind of among media slash donor slash elite circles, right? In part because it's like not really that logical. It's not that logical because, number one, a lot of Democrats are concerned about Sanders, who allegedly grope people, because a lot of Democrats were calling for Franken's resignation because Gillibrand was one of the ones who was able to be more vocal about it instead of being kind of passive aggressive. Because, by the way, it happened at a moment when there was a race, a special election in Alabama, where you had Roy Moore, who was accused of things that are, let's be clear, two or three orders of magnitude worse than what Al Franken was accused of, but still a moment where not being hypocritical on those issues might seem important. And by the way, Tina Smith, the senator who replaced Al Franken, won pretty easily last November, and so it didn't really cost Democrats anything. And so it's like a bit illogical, especially from a party that's trying to become more, excuse me, but like woke on like Me Too issues. And so I do wonder if it's like a vocal but well-connected to like national political reporters minority of elites as opposed to something more widespread. And then, you know, I find it a tricky story to cover because like on the one hand, it's a part of the conversation about her. On the other hand, I got in a conversation on Twitter last night with the New York Times reporter. I'm like, he's saying, oh, look, now Al Franken is trending on Twitter. And I'm saying, well, look, if the New York Times writes about Franken in the context of Gillibrand and the Washington Post does, even 538 does, we're pretty widely read among those elite circles too, right? Then that's going to be a part of the conversation. But is that really organic, or is that like a – at the very least – I'm sorry for the run-on sentence here, right? At the very least, I think that story should be treated as something which is relevant but like maybe could be turned around to be a positive, right?
I think this cuts a little bit to so it cuts to the changing fundraising models in the Democratic Party as well. So I think right now, first of all, the Democratic Party is kind of in a kill your idols moment, as is America, right? So while the narrative is, you know, like burn the witch that killed Al Franken's career to a certain extent from a certain obviously powerful group of donors, I think the undercovered storyline is the potential. Now, this might not be true, but it's the potential that she is able to generate more small dollars online by being a person who very publicly killed an idol. And, you know, like, Manhattan donors are generally probably older, and like Al Franken's general age, like, he is also a cultural idol to them. So we should also like factor that in. I want to move to one thing that from a few minutes ago with Gillibrand's performance in upstate counties. The one thing that I'm interested to see as her campaign becomes, you know, her candidacy becomes a national one, is we've talked a little bit on this podcast, and very smart people have written about the ways that 2016 activated these identities and politicized certain identities, gender and race, being the two biggest ones that I can think of. And I kind of wonder how that could affect someone like Gillibrand, who has performed well in conservative rural areas in the past. But I kind of am curious to see if her national perception is different, because people will see a white, wealthy woman from New York. Oh, hell no, right? I think that that's going to be an interesting dynamic to see play out. And while, you know, I didn't put this in the piece because we have the data on how she's performed electorally, but I'm also curious to see if that gender identity activates for voters, you know, particularly in Iowa, or maybe her appeal sticks and I'm totally wrong. But I think it's just something to think about with her.
I mean, a parallel is that once upon a time in the 2008 primary, Hillary Clinton did well in Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
Hillary
slamming
Clinton
shots
was the,
and
yeah, there was the blue collar candidate, and then that reversed. So I think that's a totally good point, that the frame of the primary will make a big difference in terms of how these candidates are perceived. But also, like, someone made this point earlier, you know, this is the first time we're going to have more than one woman running for a major party nomination. I should say more than one really serious, high profile female candidate. And so it'll be super interesting to see essentially how sort of sexists in the country react to different women running. You know, Claire was saying this, but I wonder if Gillibrand's emphasizing her self identity as a mom goes over better than, for example, the way Warren is putting out her profile, or what Harris might do. It's just going to be super interesting to see kind of how people react.
And know. By the way, I mean, I think people probably get this, but I mean, the other thing with the way all these candidates frame their campaigns is also like people have personalities, including politicians. And so like Gillibrand, I think, does probably identify strongly as being a mother. And like, so that's kind of the thing that comes naturally to her. It's obvious, like, I think we are pointing out, like, it's advantageous to her for a certain way to play the mother part. But I also think it's something that probably comes naturally to her. I think with Warren, you know, like, she comes from with a lot of these issues about, like, you know, she was a bankruptcy expert for so many years. Like, I think she comes with a little bit more of like this activist edge to her politics. So it is really interesting. And obviously we pay more attention, I think, to the way that women candidates kind of navigate these perception problems, which is not to say that male candidates don't have that. I mean, you know.
No, but it's a different river they're navigating for women. So it's like, in the total abstract, I would say I would agree with what Nate hinted at earlier, which is that in my mind, it seems like Democrats will want like the most anti-Trump fighter available, like a fighting personality. But I don't know if that's true for the women running, where maybe Gillibrand, if she has kind of a more agreeable persona, maybe that goes down better with sexist voters than Warren's more, I'm a counterpuncher, I'm
and,
a fighter.
And Warren's team, I'm sure, knows that she's just not going to appeal to a certain set of people, and they're already kind of discounting those people. Whereas I think Gillibrand's theory of the case is a little bit more, couldn't you see me as your general election candidate, like kind of appealing to people? And it's interesting to watch that.
It's interesting that you say that on like a tonal level, right? Because she does have the lowest Trump score. But also in that conversation with Colbert, she was like, I'm bipartisan. I've even sponsored legislation with Ted Cruz. So apart from the tonal conversation, is there appetite for bipartisanship within the Democratic primary electorate right now?
I mean,
less than there once was. I mean, look, one of the consequences of Democrats being happy with their 2018 is that, maybe not irrationally, but like, they're pretty confident in their ability to beat Trump, I would think.
So they don't feel like they need to be bipartisan.
I mean, if you look at polls, Democrats are usually more pro-bipartisanship than Republicans. Remember, Obama actually kind of won on that, you know, hey, the country's in crisis, we need solutions from both sides, right? And I think in part because
but
of...
Things have changed since then, I think.
Yeah, Democrats are less willing to compromise. They think that they get the short end of the stick when they try to bargain with Republicans. I think Republicans are intransigent, right? And I think kind of the paradigm now is like, okay, let's blitz in and we have the House, somehow win the Senate, which frankly is probably harder for Democrats than the presidency. It's another conversation we have another show, right? But they're like, let's blitz in and pass Medicare for All and make Puerto Rico and D.C. states, and then Ruth Bader Ginsburg can retire, right? And we appoint someone new, and then, you know, just kind of blitzkrieg, and then whatever. Then, yeah, we'll probably get our butts kicked in 2022 or whatever it is. But that's the nature of things, and I don't know. I think that's more the paradigm, really.
Yeah, I think
get Trump out of office, and then get all this stuff. It's our turn to like turn the tables around, right? And we have this groundswell support behind us, and so you know, so I don't think the bipartisan pitch works as well, right? Although it could be that, like, you know, again, it's like there's different phases almost. If Trump were really popular, then people might say, "Oh, we have to move toward the center and be more bipartisan," right? If he were like really, really, really unpopular, I know he's unpopular now, but like let's say he had a 30% approval rating and he was somehow running for re-election anyway, and it was just kind of clear he was going to lose, and you might almost be like, oh, we're in a crisis and we have to like start building this gigantic majority for the future, and like then you might also see, I mean, you saw a little bit of that kind of more magnanimous tone from Obama in 2008 when it seemed like he was going to win kind of for sure, and then I don't know, although there were moments of doubt in that campaign. We're kind of in the in-between zone where like Trump feels like very beatable, you know, but Democrats also can't take too much for granted. And so anyway, I just think that psychologically that amounts to like the bipartisan message certainly not resonating very well in the primary.
Why do we think Trump's very beatable? I mean, like,
I don't think he's very beatable.
Yeah, I guess
I think he's beatable.
I'm curious about that, or like what your thinking is on that, because the Democrats also are going to have, I believe the technical term is, a shit ton of candidates who could cannibalize each other. I mean,
right now
everyone's being very happy, lovey-dovey, but what if they, you know, kind of get, what if it turns a little nasty and that's good for Trump? I mean, obviously there are a lot of X factors with Trump, but I'm curious about your thinking.
Right now, Trump's approval rating is 14 or 15 points underwater. One reason why Trump's beatable is because he needs something to change between now and 2020. He needs some way to become more popular with swing voters, and or he needs the economy to improve. Well, the economy is already very good, so it's like pretty hard, right? But like, you know, he's not very popular, and it's a kind of a pretty quirky set of circumstances for him to win, despite also, frankly, not being very popular in 2016. It took a candidate in Hillary Clinton who was nearly as unpopular as he was. It took the fact that among voters who disliked both candidates, those voters also went for Trump because they're like, why not take a chance? And it took him winning the Electoral College despite losing the popular vote. And he needed all three of those things to occur. And I don't know, maybe you'll get one, maybe you'll get two. But like, I don't know. I mean, this is a whole other conversation again.
Yeah.
But like, but the fact that he has come out of this midterm catering to the, I don't know if you want to call it the rightmost part, but the most insurgent part of the Republican base, and the shutdown and the wall and threatening an emergency declaration, does not speak well to his ability to win, to run the most rational campaign to maximize his chance of getting reelected. And again, we can have a very, very long debate about like where would you actually peg Trump's odds. You know, if you had to force me to give an answer, I'd say in the neighborhood if he runs for reelection.
Don't give it.
In the neighborhood of even. So it's safe, right?
So he's beatable,
he
but
can
he's
never
not
be wrong.
Very beatable.
In the neighborhood of even. Okay, and I am sure that we will have this conversation again.
Galen's done.
But to wrap on Kirsten Gillibrand, because that is what this conversation is about, who do we see as her main competition? And we'll end on that in this wide field of likely candidates.
Seth Moulton.
No comment.
Shady answer from Micah.
Well, like, listen, let's be real realistic here.
Women,
like, yeah. People will just group women together, women candidates. But I do think actually she has a decent amount in common with Harris as far as I think stuff in their professional history, career history could give them trouble. Harris has the prosecutor thing and her background, which makes her like a little more unattractive to people on the left.
What about Klobuchar?
Sorry?
Klobuchar, there's a bit of... I mean, Klobuchar has not run to her left, but I think there is, like, stylistically...
No one knows that much about Amy Klobuchar.
Maybe outside of New York, nobody
why,
knows
Well, Booker,
much
because
about.
They're...
Regional, I think...
Oh, they're both kind of, like, going to be the happy warrior.
Yeah, that's a good way to put
They've
it.
They've also
yeah.
been pretty establishment in the past and have run far to the left over the past 2 years.
Yeah, what you guys said. Booker. Why Klobuchar, Nate?
He likes talking about her.
They're both women. They're both running on, like, the mom thing a little bit. I mean, I think they both kind of...
Mom.
Look,
like
I think...
Midwesterner.
Mom. I think Gillibrand is one of those people that implicitly is making an electability argument,
yes.
right? She's saying, I am a... Are we allowed to call candidates good-looking? Such as Beto O'Rourke. You know,
yeah,
she's a good-looking...
You know, as long as we refer to both genders there.
Like Beto O'Rourke, she is a good-looking candidate. And she has won both in fairly conservative districts and in a very liberal state, right? And I think it would be saying, like, I can raise money and I'm someone who is electable, competent, low-risk alternative to Donald Trump.
Can I be an asshole and ask you to explain why we had to mention the good-looking thing? Let's academicize it if we're going to talk about
it.
I
think the real answer is because the country is sexist and probably wouldn't vote for a less attractive woman.
This is where I'll put in. I mean... Ocasio-Cortez is found attractive by many people. She's also the subject of a lot of vitriol, as was Sarah Palin, another person who people said was very good looking. So I guess I'll say, as Helen of Troy might tell you, being a good looking woman in public life cuts both ways, guys. Anyway, I seriously don't know.
Like, I'm just saying, but like she's running on kind of agreeableness for
correct.
Now.
Yeah, I think that's
and like.
Sort of, but she's also like really hitting culturally
sweet,
liberal positions.
Speak sweetly, carry a big stick, right? Or,
yeah.
You know, vote, carry a big anti-Trump okay. vote thing. I know what you mean.
Think,
I know what you mean. I just wanted to spell
think
it out.
That among the candidates, we don't think that among them, she might be among the more likely to triangulate and flip-flop a little bit in the general election. Again, I can make an argument that like flip-flopping is perfectly appropriate. And even
and
healthy in representative government.
And that she has done it in the past.
But she has, president. Like, she carefully calibrates her message to her audience in a way that's, like, quite skilled in some ways. Although I think that's also a bit gendered, right? The notion
yeah.
of, like, opportunistic is a word you hear a lot about her, and I wonder about that
well, I think that's,
a little bit.
But I think that's maybe something we didn't talk as much about, but how that, like, I could very easily see, let's say, what we used to call the Bernie Bros, taking Gillibrand's record and saying... all of those things that Nate just said. She's opportunistic, blah, blah, blah. You know, her supporters would say she had a, let's put it out there, rather convenient timing-wise change of heart when she went from representing a conservative upstate district to realizing that downstate in New York, she had basically like a multi-ethnic progressive coalition and she needed to make nice with them. She's had pretty conservative stances on immigration. But I think that her progressive allies now would say, well, listen, she was exposed to more people, she saw the light of day, blah, blah, blah. But I can very easily see that record being weaponized against her. You know, her 2006 to 2009 years where she was in public office and,
yeah.
or 2007 to 2009.
It'll be interesting to see if voters treat a woman with this kind of history differently because they've accepted the you know, what was the Etch-a-Sketch version of Mitt Romney historically, right? I mean, we've had plenty of...
Trump.
And right. Trump, of
yeah.
course.
It's and, like, that's the thing is maybe we're... Like, I think it is very noteworthy to talk about her record flip. But also, maybe we are in this sort of post... Maybe politics has changed so much that, yeah, people are kind of like, well... There's been a lot of cultural evolution in America in the past couple of years. I've talked to people who say there's been a lot of bad stuff that's been happening in the past few years, you know, violent protests about police shootings, you know, for people who are against Trump, immigration stuff. And while all those bad things happen, there's been like there's a silver lining to it in that people are exposed to more things. So you could make the argument that like white women like Kirsten Gillibrand have been exposed to more things that say her downstate coalition of minorities see as part of their everyday life. I don't know. It's like this really slippery thing.
Well, and every single candidate who's now supporting Medicare for All must have evolved on that issue because wasn't even a talking point.
Whenever I think of flip-flopping, I always think of Terry Gross's interview with Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
Where Terry Gross was a dog with a bone who would not let go, where she several times called... I don't remember exactly how she phrased it, but she was like, you used to not support gay marriage. Why? Why did you have such a quick change of heart? Clinton gives the rote politician answer. And Terry Gross goes, but why? Why'd you change it? And it was the one time where you saw, like, Clinton really got riled by it. But it was like a great interview question because it kind of exposed, like, this sore point.
But that's telling.
Look it up. Terry Gross.
I think there is a gender thing going on here where every politician has changed their stance on, like, every issue. That's an exaggeration, but it was a thing for Clinton. The country just elected President Trump, who literally changed on every position over the course of his lifetime and over the course of the campaign. I just don't think it's an
issue
for voters.
He's always been pro-hamburger, though.
That is true. He is pro-hamburger.
Isn't it hamburger?
Many, many fries.
All right.
Can I just say I've had a craving for McDonald's ever since then?
I'm so hungry.
And with that.
I am so hungry.
Everyone's hungry, so I think this is the time to wrap the podcast that was largely about Kirsten Gillibrand, but veered into various other directions as well.
We're just open, agreeable people.
Maybe Joe Biden is her biggest competition.
Oh, that's I like that. Maybe we should do a podcast that's just about, like, the internecine rivalries of the primaries. This maybe for a later date.
All right. That's a wrap. Nate, thank you so much. I hope you get a hamburger soon.
Thank you, Galen.
Claire, thank you.
Thanks.
Micah, thank you.
Thanks.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps others discover the show. Or just tell someone about us. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you soon.